proudly student and listener-supported community radio. CIUT 89.5 FM, the sound of your city.
Good morning. Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. By the way, I'm going to tell you at the top, there's a new show at CIUT, going to be at 5 o'clock today, and it's called Blinded by Science, the AI Chronicles with Dr. K. That's at 5 o'clock, a new show on CIUT. And we'll be talking today about a number of matters. First of all, I want to say our guest is going to be Judy Reaver. She is the author of a wonderful book called Rwanda's 30-Year Assault on Congo, The Crimes, the Criminals, and the Cover-Up. And Judy Reaver is an investigative journalist from Montreal who covered the overthrow of Congo President Mobutu Sese Seko and the humanitarian crisis that ensued in 1997. She has investigated atrocities committed by the Paul Kagame forces for 30 years and is the author of the award-winning book, In Praise of Blood, The Crimes of the Rwandan Patriotic Front. And I believe she's joining us now. Are you there, Judy?
I am. Hi, Phil.
Hi. Boy, I'm glad to be talking to you. This is a great book. Very compact, full of information that I don't think most Canadians have seen. You know, people tend to think that they've heard a lot about this, a lot of headlines and various important people comment. But I believe that most of the population remain in the dark, and I think that should be part of what we talk about today. But it struck me that you tackle the issues right from the get-go in the book. 30 years ago, and I guess that's 1996, there was an onslaught into Congo, very complicated political thing at the time. If people were reading the headlines, they certainly wouldn't have seen what is revealed in your book. And here we are today with still living with the consequence of that first invasion in 96. The circumstances have hardly improved, and we seem to have a burning issue in eastern Congo. But I just to set the stage, if you don't mind telling us, underground issue, literally, of what this is all about. But in your opening section, you say this is an area of where of resources. I've been looking for the actual phrase, but the global resource battle. So, what is it that interests the wealthy countries of the world in this poor country of 124 million people? Can you talk about those resources and what it has caused, why it's caused Western capitals to be very, very hungry for it?
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting question. It really is at the root of the violence, because in many ways, I've talked about this a lot, in many ways the global economy begins in Central Africa. It begins in Congo. There are an estimated 24 trillion dollars in natural resources in Congo. And it is, you may know, it's Congo's the biggest world producer of cobalt. That's a strategic metal that's essential for aerospace, defense industries, energy, and it's the second biggest producer now of copper.
Mm-hmm.
So really, you know, the United States in particular was very interested in opening up this rich economic corridor for multinationals and global capitalists. And that's basically what occurred with the overthrowing of Mobutu, because I've tracked the production levels of a lot of the mining resources, a lot of the minerals, and they had plummeted under Mobutu. Mobutu had served the United States and the West as, as a linchpin against communism.
Mm.
But really, the West could not get at this $24 trillion worth of natural resources that they wanted to. And I've tracked the cobalt particular and copper levels,
mm-hmm.
which had plummeted and after the overthrow of Mobutu have just skyrocketed. So it's there. The economic rationale for regime change, which I discussed in my book,
mm-hmm.
was very much there. And we've since seen that economic exploitation, which is at the root cause of the war, it's an engine
mm-hmm.
For our global economy.
Yeah. We're speaking to Judy Reaver, and the book is Rwanda's 30-Year Assault on Congo, and it's barakabooks.com. I want to keep urging people to make sure you get this book. The beginning really was, they always have told this story that, well, Mobutu was a dictator, and the people were unhappy with him, and somehow it became an excuse, and I think your book uses that word, to overthrow him was to create an issue on the border between Rwanda and Congo. And what was that issue, and how did they exploit it?
Well, the context was that there were more than a million Hutu refugees living inside Zaire, inside Congo's border. And these were people who had fled violence after the Rwandan genocide. And, of course, the regime in place was led by Paul Kagame, who's Tutsi, and his Tutsi forces seized power in July 1994 after a bloodbath violence. And so the narrative that was being pushed at the time was simply, Bill, that these refugees who had fled Rwanda and installed themselves and were living in those camps posed a security risk for the post-genocide government and Rwanda in developing. And so the West and sort of all the Western sponsors of Kagame pushed this narrative. And so, number one, those camps had to be dismantled. And at the same time, so there was this justification for an invasion, dismantling, disbanding these refugee camps, which were seen as a security risk, even though the vast majority of these refugees living in the camps were civilians and posed no security risk. And also responding to repression by an ethnic, repression of an ethnic Tutsi minority, the Banyamulenge. But, I mean, there was sort of a concerted effort going on in Washington, and I lay this out, briefings and so forth, right before the invasion, within a few weeks of the invasion, to mm-hmm. kind of manufacture consent for the ousting of Mobutu. We talk about why Mobutu had to be ousted, but basically we have the U.S. ambassador at the time to Zaire, Congo, Daniel Simpson, holding a briefing in D.C. So he'd left Kinshasa, was in D.C., holding a briefing at the Center for Strategic and International Studies for journalists and policy wonks, and basically manufacturing consent for the ousting, bemoaning the state of the economy. Mm-hmm. He was flanked as well by the U.S. ambassador to Uganda, Michael Southwick, mm-hmm. and the CIA, former CIA station chief in Kinshasa, Larry Devlin. Now, Devlin was the guy, the main guy who was involved in the assassination of Congo's former leader, Patrice Lumumba.
Isn't that remarkable? I was so startled when I read that it seems like an old-school operation. All these guys had been there in the area overthrowing governments, assassinating leaders, mm-hmm. and they're sort of like somebody put it on their desk, we want you to get Mobutu. and he says, well, yeah, I could do that because he's done it before, right?
Yeah, exactly. I was astonished to get a hold of this video of the briefing. And I did, of course, after I spoke to Daniel Simpson. He has since passed, this ambassador. He passed away a few years ago. But it's extraordinary. And, of course, he denied the U.S. Conducted regime change, of course, mm-hmm. Because that would have been under his watch. Mm-hmm. But he distanced himself in kind of a tough interview I did, a series of interviews. He distanced himself from his U.S. colleagues at the time who were in Kigali in Rwanda when I presented him with a lot of evidence that I lay out in my book. And he admitted to me that the U.S. has always liked efficient, militarized killers. Those were his words.
Yeah, they... By the way, this is, again, I tell the listeners, among the reasons you need to read this book is that these players are interviewed, you interviewed two or three of them in depth, mm-hmm. and these were the operatives, rather cold-blooded individuals. By the way, they were so frank with you. In the case of Ambassador Simpson, he said, well, the Tutsi can't believe they cannot rule without killing. Because he didn't fill it out, but they're a minority. But he just said it, and he said, and maybe they're right.
Yeah, it was really extraordinary, some of the things he said. But by the time I spoke to him, I first spoke to him in 2009, because I've been doing this so long, he admitted to me that Congo was a catastrophe. I mean, this is a man who... had argued in papers. He's very erudite, a very shrewd, he had served in hot spots around the world, Somalia, Lebanon. He had been placed in Zaire a year before this regime change. He had been deputy commander of U.S. War College. You know, he was very shrewd, but he admitted to me that Congo was a catastrophe.
Yeah. Not that they care that much, that because you point out in the book, I mean, as it is a catastrophe, it's horrific. Loss of life goes on even now. But as the catastrophe exists, so does the mining of the minerals and the enrichment of... The group in Kigali and some in Uganda, they're lining their pockets. So it's a catastrophe for the ordinary person, but not for the guy with the bank account, right?
That's right, yeah. I mean, we've seen how over the years, Paul Kagame, not only in invading and unleashing 30 years of war, he's also during that time ruled over a sort of controlled chaos in Eastern Congo. Mm-hmm. And we've seen Rwanda illegally export and traffic Congolese minerals. Mm-hmm. And that has been the fuel for this conflict. And what we're talking about there in the trafficking, we're talking about artisanal minerals, tantalum, tin, and tungsten, all so key to the global economy, to everything that we need for energy and aeronautics and defense industries. And so he has ensured, talking about Paul Kagame here, this cheap, steady supply of those minerals. Cheap is very, it's not only steady supply, but cheap, because Congo is not sovereign. It certainly is not sovereign in those eastern Kivu provinces. And those minerals are essential to the global economy. And so I've said, and I've publicly, that our thirst for technology has enabled his criminal longevity. That is really what has kept Kagame in the game and has sealed his protection by the West and also by Asia, which processes and refines these minerals that they use as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was granted, you know, the backdrop, one of the backdrops to this tragedy is the consensus that developed to refer to the genocide in Rwanda, placing all responsibility on one political side and also an ethnic population, Hutu, largely Hutu. Mm-hmm. And my memory is that instead of saying they are refugees from Rwanda, they criminalized them, demonized them to the point where they were created an appetite to attack a refugee camp more than a million people, and they were scattered, of course, or some in Benin and some in Tanzania. But they by making so much of the issue of genocide and placing it on one side of the ledger, there really was an appetite to invade them, to kill them, to drive them out, because they were all, they criminalized. And the people you interviewed, they spoke that way. One of them, I think it was the guy you referred to as our man in Kisangani, mm-hmm. He said his job was to separate the militants from the other refugees. Mm-hmm. What an absurd job. And because it's a fake story, in my opinion. But let me just ask one last thing related to that. What happened to the right of refugees to be refugees? They developed a consensus that they should be driven, as your book points out very clearly, pushed back. There's a French word for it, which I have trouble with, refoulement. But they have to. That was a violation of the UN Charter, or certainly the Charter, consensus on a refugees' right not to be forced to return. Mm-hmm. But they did it, and I think you quote Susan Rice. She was one of the leaders. Could you talk about that?
Well, just going back to Hudak at the time, he was the most, you mentioned him, the most senior U.S. official on the ground, right? And he was ostensibly tasked with, at the time, separating, which was ridiculous, separating armed elements from the refugee population, from the bona fide refugee. It was ridiculous because he did not do that at all. He did nothing of the sort. He didn't even go into, I asked him specifically, did you go into the refugee camp south of Kisangani where you were based, where all this killing had occurred? Kagame's Tutsi troops came in and slaughtered upwards of, in south of Kisangani only, upwards of 40,000 very ill refugees, most of whom were old people and children and women. Mm-hmm. The more able-bodied had gone on. He said he couldn't remember what he was there to do. He was working for the CIA. He did not protect or repatriate refugees mm-hmm. at all. And
the large and the further they were supposed not only if suppose you did drive them back. I read the human rights report, and they say be sure you protect them, those who are repatriated.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't do that.
No, they didn't. I mean, and there's the former head of the UNHCR, the UN agency for refugees, the GOMA office. Her name is Masako Yonakawa. She's written extensively on this. She was on the ground at the time. She also worked in Rwanda. And she said the United States, for geopolitical reasons, helped organize this forced return, the refoulement. And where they faced, as you mentioned, persecution, mistreatment, and danger. And that covered up. It allowed the UN to install the new regime, which would serve its political and economic interests, and it allowed them to cover up to some extent at the number of victims killed by Kagame's forces in Congo. And remember, Phil, I mean, and this is a very modest number. The United Nations estimated with Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, that up to 200,000 Rwandan Hutu refugees disappeared or were killed during Kagame's military sweep during this invasion that we're talking about in 1996, 1997. And the United Nations later classified those crimes by Kagame's troops as a possible genocide. There has been no prosecution, no judicial further action against Kagame or any of his senior officers. But this was a genocide that happened in Congo. And we don't know how many people who were forcefully, who survived the attacks in the Congolese jungle and then were forcefully repatriated against their will to Rwanda, how many of the people who went home then disappeared. Mm-hmm. It is really devastating and criminal. And not to mention the millions of people, of course, in Congo, the Congolese who have died because of 3 decades of war.
Yeah. And on that element, I mean, you raise this, and this certainly anyone who's tried to follow this has noticed that they give a lot of attention to guarantee that they prevail in what you could call the information war. And I noticed that some of the people that you interviewed and spoke about as their active roles, they were used as authority figures. So when you mention Miss Austin, or Austin, I take her figure a second. Oh, pardon me, Kathy Austin. Mm-hmm. They can put the kibosh on her. They say, "Well, we don't trust her. Maybe she didn't. She's not ready." And so all they do is use a kind of a heavyweight who actually has no, who's lying through his teeth to get rid of evidence, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I've interviewed all these guys. Okay. You know, the war managers. And so the U.S. ambassador in Kigali at the time was, his name is Robert Gribben. And so Kigali is where U.S. operations for the regime change had their headquarters. Okay. So that's where the United States waged information war there on behalf of Kagame's government. And as I point out in the book, and this is Robert Gribben denies this, but that's where these headquarters in Kigali at the U.S. Embassy, that's where logistics and intelligence and reconnaissance, command and control communications for Kagame's military sweep in Congo, that's where the headquarters were. Okay, there were also, so he he presided over that, Robert Gribben, as U.S. ambassador, along with his deputy, Peter Whaley. And there were also U.S. mobile teams in the war theater in Congo helping with a lot of intelligence teams. And if you look back at the time, Robert Gribben, and particularly his deputy, Peter Whaley, were minimizing, distorting, denying the reality on the ground. No, the refugees are not disappearing. No, the refugees are not being attacked, even though as a young journalist, I was covering this. So were humanitarian workers. The United Nations was sounding the alarm. And you mentioned Kathy Austin, who was a researcher, investigator, who wrote reports. She presented her findings that the United States had trained Rwandan soldiers before the invasion. You know, all these people were discredited by Robert Gribben and his deputy. And so there was, information warfare. And that was that was part of the military task force that was set up in order to conduct a regime change.
I remember an aspect of it. By the way, once again, Canada had an ignominious role in this. They'd use the game of saying, well, we're going to ask the Canadians to look into it. And at first, Jean Chrétien said, they weren't taking an interest. They thought that was not the... But he said his wife was watching television one night, and she saw these camps. And so she said, oh, that looks terrible. Jean, you should do something. So he said, all right, we're going to help. We're going to go looking too. And then they came back and said, well, there's really not much there. You name Baril, who, by the way, has been in on this from day one because he was deeply involved in Rwanda in 1994. So could you talk about that, how Canada just kind of nicely came in and helped with the American apologetics?
Well, Baril was Canada's chief of defense staff, right? So he had been appointed to head a Canadian-led force to ostensibly protect the refugees. But Baril presented a report to the United Nations in December in 1996. And he basically told the UN that he could only find a very few Rwandan refugees, that originally, like, the 150,000 he had observed in the forest with the help of satellite images had were now untraceable. And he said there were no signs that refugees were being forced to move further west or that they were being mistreated or they needed urgent need of assistance, which was diametrically opposed to what humanitarian organizations and journalists like myself were reporting and what the refugees were saying. They were systematically being slaughtered. So he put the kibosh on the multinational force. His report gave the green light for Kagame to hunt down hundreds of thousands of Hutus in Congo. He has blood on his hands.
The details in your book, by the way, it's amazing you managed to get all this into basically 100 pages. And by the way, it's a wonderful footnote. And I hope people really have to read it because there's all those quotation marks. That is to say, this person is saying this, and you need to know about it. One of the things you wrote in this book, I'm going to read a bit of it. It says, on April 16, 1997, a month before Mobutu was toppled, and a week before the Rwanda Patriotic Army machine-gunned and slashed refugees in Kisangani, the Rebel Alliance signed a U.S. $1 billion deal. Rebel Alliance signed a $1 billion deal with America Mineral Fields, a mining company listed in Vancouver and Toronto, whose headquarters was in Hope, Arkansas, President Clinton's hometown. Jean-Raymond Boulle, the company CEO, gave the Rebel Alliance the use of his Learjet and advanced U.S. $1 million in mineral taxes and fees to Laurent Kabila in return for a contract to rehabilitate and develop the country's zinc and copper mines, a project that was estimated to be worth U.S. $16 billion. On May 9, a few days before the Rwanda soldiers threw refugees into the river at Bandaka, Buhl flew a group of 30 investment bankers, market analysts, and U.S. officials to Lubumbashi. Among the companies who were on the trip were two Canadian firms, CIBC, Wood Gundy and Bunting Warburg, an arm of London's SBC Warburg, along with U.S. investment companies Goldman Sachs from Switzerland and Deutsche Morgan Grenfell Johannesburg office. Aboard the South African chartered Boeing 727 was Robin Sanders, Director of American Affairs for the U.S. National Security Council. Now, that is hands-on invasion by companies, practically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's more blood-curdling than talking about Tutsis like to murder Hutus. I mean, this is just, they gave Kabila their company jet.
Yeah.
I'd invite you to elaborate on that. I've never seen anything quite so, it's like pirates or something.
Well, you know, AMF was among a few companies that financed the rebels. We also have the Canadian-Swedish group, Lunden, entering into economic deals with the copper and cobalt mining deals. And we have a huge, series of Western players, companies, mostly U.S., but some Canadian entities, Tenke, First Quantum Minerals, Harambe Mining, Panama Resources. In those early days of the invasion, it's really quite extraordinary, the descent of multinationals in the newly configured Congo that was liberated by Kagame. But it really... And some of these companies have come and gone, of course. We have a lot
So has Kabila.
Yes, Kabila, didn't last that long because he turned on. He was seen as a puppet.
Mm-hmm.
But he turned on his puppet masters and then was replaced very quickly by his son, Joseph Kabila, who became rather close. He became a tool, as far as I'm concerned, of Yoweri Museveni and Paul Kagame for many years. And now he seems to be allied with the occupiers, with not only Paul Kagame, but the M23 Kagame's militia in Eastern Congo now.
Your book says he's there now, or he was there only a few months ago.
Yeah, he
in Goma.
Yeah, he's often in Zimbabwe too, but yeah, he's basically in M23 controlled areas.
Yeah. Instead of countries, it's like following gangsters. They seem to be interchangeable parts. I mean, that he's the son of Kabila, who ended up dead because he said he told Kagame he didn't want Rwandans trying to run Congo, so they decided to overthrow him. He ended up dead, and his son ends up working for the guy who killed his father. Right? This is kind of mob stuff.
Well, I state that he's committed treason against the Congolese state, right? But
he is wanted for treason.
Not only for his alliance with M23 rebels, but for this long-standing alliance he's had with Kagame, but also for promoting a steady stream of generals who worked with Kagame over the years in these wars of conquest. Mm-hmm. So he's associated and complicit in the deaths of millions of Congolese.
Yes. My understanding is he has been found guilty and condemned by the Parliament or Congress of Congo for treason, right?
He's been tried.
Maybe I've got my fingers crossed. That would be a good thing.
But he's free to go as he pleases, and in occupied zones of eastern Congo or going back and forth to Zimbabwe. It's pretty nasty stuff.
Yes. We're speaking with Judy Reaver. She's very generous with her time. The book is Rwanda's 30-Year Assault on Congo, The Crimes, The Criminals, The Cover-Up, and it's fact-loaded and with quotations from people who ordinarily don't get talked to. By the way, you're the type of journalist who notices these gentlemen and actually confronts them. They don't tend to be confronted. They're always being petted or patted on the back or used for some other purpose. But the role of the U.S. in all this is really underlined by your book. A tribunal was created. And in the Human Rights Report that I read, that, again, thanks to your book, they said, look at these crimes being committed in Congo. They should include these crimes at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda because it involves all the same elements and et cetera. Well, that was total silence. No such thing ever happened. These tribunals have seemed to me to be basically going along with the consensus, an information consensus created by the Americans. And they only try those that they've designated that they want to remove from the scene.
Mm-hmm.
But talk about, I guess, the magic word, Kagame's impunity and his organization, the RPF. They have impunity. And last point, I was in the courtroom. Louise Arbour said, we have come to Africa to establish this court because we're going to end the culture of impunity in Africa. And that was a phrase that they italicized, and all journalists began to write it for about 2 weeks. We're ending the culture of impunity.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if anybody's got impunity, it must be Mr. Kagame, and probably is some white people from the United States.
Well, the ICTR, where you worked, I mean, you'd know about the culture there, granted Kagame de facto immunity. And so they've had a hand in fueling this war. And I say that if the ICTR, the UN tribunal set up to prosecute the most serious crimes in 1994 in Rwanda, if that tribunal had done its job and indicted Kagame and his senior officials for the crimes committed, not only based on evidence that was absolutely solid at the time, that Kagame and his commandos had shot down the plane and triggered the violence, but also the industrial-level killing that I have investigated over the years, but that the UN had evidence on. So if they had indicted him, as they should have, properly conducted legal investigations and prosecutions, then this war would barely have started, would not have been waged.
They wouldn't have been able to do it, right?
No, exactly. So this is why I say that the United Nations and all these lawyers, they have blood on their hands as well, because they, in granting him judicial immunity, they've fueled the culture of impunity, but they've granted him the means to wage the war. Okay? And this has been going on far too long. Just as the United Nations Tribunal, the International Criminal Court, ICC in The Hague, that whose mandate started, okay, in 2002, but from 2002 onward, those lawyers and Luis Ocampo, Morena Ocampo, who's chief prosecutor, they had the means and the evidence to prosecute Kagame and stop his barbarity and his dark campaign of violence. And they chose not to for political reasons. Yeah. And they refused to even bring in his chief, his most dangerous and sadistic warlords who were killing and raping the Congolese in eastern Kivu. So, I mean, when you look at the level of responsibility of the West in this, it's astonishing. And for that reason only, the level of imperialism, the level of deception and immorality, and this is really the reason I wrote the book, and yes, it's a short book that reflects kind of the way we read and absorb information now in the modern age, but these are the reasons I wrote the book, to tackle the level of imperialism that still exists.
Well, you indict them out of their own mouths. I have to say, that's what the quotes in the book, you point out that one of the prosecutors that got bumped aside was Carla Del Ponte, because she said, well, yes, you know, if you look at it, Kagame should have been prosecuted, but she was removed. And then you actually quote a prosecutor who spoke to you asking for anonymity, but he said, we let them get away.
I mean, so, the man I spoke to, he had a very illustrious career at the both the tribunal for Rwanda and the former Yugoslavia, and he also worked at the ICC. He was very well known, and he told me that he believed that Kagame had the bad guy had gotten away.
Gotten away
with it, and he called it a malicious conspiracy. Now, I mean, he presided over this time, right? But he basically said that you know, Kagame would have been the ultimate indictee, and for a lot of reasons that, you know, that are clear now, the United States was intent on protecting Kagame. And as I've pointed out in my first book, the U.S. ambassador for war crimes wasn't even working at the ICTR. He's working for the United States, Pierre Prosper. He brokered a deal to transfer, and I showed the document in my first book, to transfer the jurisdiction, if you can believe this, of investigating RPF crimes from the ICTR, from the UN tribunal, to Kigali, to Kagame's Ministry of Justice, Department of Justice. So letting the killers investigate themselves for the crimes committed. I mean, it's such a farce.
Yes. You mentioned that he was the U.S. ambassador for war crimes. They used to say the ambassador for genocide, et cetera, the Pierre Prosper. I knew him somewhat. He said, pardon me, I left out something. He was the leading prosecutor under Arbour at the beginning of the tribunal. So he had been prosecuting the defeated Rwandans. And later he ends up the ambassador. And he left quite a trail. By the way, one prosecutor told me, I mean, just privately, he said, well, if I had anything to do with it, we would have prosecuted some of the RPF guys. He said it would have looked better. Yeah, would it look better? That's kind of a nice term to put on the loss of millions of lives and the ongoing exploitation of Congo. One last thing, if I could. I mean, I really appreciate you being generous with your time. This is Judy Reaver. It's BarakaBooks.com, and it's Rwanda's 30-year assault on Congo, the crimes, the criminals, and the cover-up. This business of the U.S. association with the main players, particularly the ones best armed and creating the havoc, goes way back. You point out that Paul Kagame was a part of the Ugandan army. I believe he was a general, and wasn't it intelligence was his field? But the Americans and Mr. Kagame are sort of joined at the hip. Could you talk about that?
Well, he had officially, he was a deputy intelligence chief, military intelligence chief for Yoweri Museveni in the 80s, okay? And by the way, Robert Hudek, who was, I point out, was working for the CIA in Congo, Robert Hudek had been a career ambassador, a career diplomat. He was the U.S. ambassador to Uganda in the mid to late 80s when the United States chose to make Yoweri Museveni a linchpin for U.S. geopolitical interests in Central Africa. So that was the time that the U.S. began, they turned on the financial aid and greatly started to increase their level of political and military support. Mm-hmm. Because it was at that time that Yoweri Museveni and Paul Kagame were seen as these pivots, these very important linchpins for U.S. Political interests and economic interests. So the other big interest here was they used these two men to ward off is any influence of Islam, particularly from Sudan, further north in Central Africa. So it wasn't only the economic interest, but they were tied to, you know, using these two men as agents for all intents and purposes. And I say that Kagame has ended up being, after 30 years, as bad as Yoweri Museveni has been in Uganda, his influence is stark. But Kagame is the worst criminal agent of U.S. imperialism that in modern times.
Yeah.
So he was groomed from the 80s and from the 1990s after Kagame launched, invaded northern Rwanda and launched his Scorched Earth campaign.
Scorched Earth. Very
yes,
important.
Which displaced up to 1 million people before the Rwandan genocide, you know, displaced and killed Hutus in the north and villages. And none of those crimes were prosecuted.
Mm-hmm.
And none of the crimes, as I mentioned earlier, that his troops committed during this three-month orgy of violence that is called the Rwanda genocide, none of those crimes that he committed, especially in the eastern prefectures and in the north, were ever prosecuted. So he's been protected until this day, 3 decades of war in Congo, and you know, his days might be numbered now. The United States, under the Trump administration, feels that it's more important now to do business with Etienne Tshisekedi, with Felix rather Tshisekedi, the current Congolese president, and maybe Kagame might be a relic of the past. But there is no sign that the U.S. is ready to sanction Kagame for the current crimes Rwanda and his militia are committing, and there's no sign that the United States is wanting to open up the archives and reveal the level of support and the complicity in these crimes. Because, you know, U.S. officials will be shown to have aided and abetted massive war crimes over decades. Mm-hmm. And that's what I talk about in the last part of the book.
It's their problem. Part of their problem is that they're in it together. So it's as you mentioned, talking about these war managers. Part of the trick is to keep a little separation between themselves and the people they're managing. It's a brilliant book. It makes me think of The Quiet American by Graham Greene, where it seems to be the same process, where you have these quiet gentlemen moving around and bad things happening in their wake. It's a brilliant book. Rwanda's 30-year assault on Congo, The Crimes, The Criminals, and The Cover-Up by Judy Reaver, BarakaBooks.com. Judy, we're really grateful. It's great to talk to you. It's a wonderful book.
Thank you so much, Phil, for having me.
Thank you. Talk again. Bye-bye.
Bye.
This is Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. We have Papa Wemba, Congo, Zaire.